This episode of the Potato Field with Spudman is brought to you by the 1-4 Group Incorporated, a leading supplier of innovative dormancy and sprout inhibiting products for the potato storage industry. They are dedicated to the continued development of new and improved post-harvest chemical applications through collaborative efforts with leading university researchers and private industry. Find out more at 1-4group.com. Welcome to the Potato Field podcast with Spudman editor Zeke Jennings. I am joined today by one of the premier growers in the Columbia Basin, as one of his fellow growers described him, Mr. Grant Morris of Schneider Farms, which is based in Pasco. Grant is a member of the Washington State Potato Commission and a member of the National Potato Council. He's located in processing potato country up there in the Columbia Basin. So, Grant, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Let's get right into, you are partners with Ed Schneider, who the operation is named after. How did that partnership come about? How'd you get to know Ed?
You know, I was in WSU and I was getting ready to graduate. Is probably April, I'd say. And my uncle grows potatoes as well, knew Ed. And he always points out that he's, you know, responsible for my success. So Chip Erickson, he knew a guy that needed a guy and knew a guy that needed a guy. So put us together and they were cutting seed. I came down, I think spring break, and met him down at the seed cutter and just real brief and shook hands, and that was the beginning of it. Got graduated and hit the road, and here I am today. It just kept on going.
Did he, you know, ask you about your long-term plans, anything like that? Was he kind of just looking for somebody to share the load with?
You know, I don't know his exact motivation, but it wasn't on his side anyways. What we weren't necessarily talking, you know, forever. He had had a long-term guy kind of helping him, and then a guy out of college came and helped him for a year, but he knew he wasn't going to stick around. And then he was actually kind of doing all the water and everything himself that spring. So I think in his mind, he probably would have liked to think something was gonna be long-term, but I don't know that he was, you know, necessarily counting on that, especially having somebody come in. He didn't even know who they were. You know, we didn't know each other's names prior to that. I had never even heard the last name. I went to high school with his nephew and college with his nephew, but I didn't know anything about Ed. So I think in my mind, I had longer term stuff. I know I wasn't, this is what I wanted to do. And I knew it, you know, not necessarily potatoes, but farming. And so I made that pretty clear to him. I think he at least took it maybe, oh, let's see how it goes. And it never stopped. So I think it worked out pretty well.
And yeah, go back to that. If you knew coming out of college or even going into college that you wanted to be an ag, do you have an ag rep background? Did you grow up on a farm?
Yeah, you know, my dad always was on farms. He didn't farm his own ground until I was in high school, but that's what he did. He was ran farms. We lived in Oregon for a while and ran a farm down there. And so I knew, I don't remember a time in my life where that's not what I wanted to do. You go to college and people are bouncing around, take all their general requirements and they don't know what they're doing. They change their degree and they waste a bunch of time. I've been lucky. I've known since day one. Again, like when I was a little kid, I remember my aunt, you know, asking me if I wanted to be a farmer when I grew up, and I got mad at her and said, I am a farmer. You know, I probably was second grade or something. You know, I took that personal. So I haven't always lived on a farm. We lived in town for a while my dad managed farms and did things. But for the most part of my life, I've been out in the country and on other people's farms and been lucky enough to get that and for myself and do exactly what I want to do. I feel pretty lucky that way. I've never had a doubt, and I've always known I've always had a goal, right? I didn't have to worry about doubting that.
What type of crops did you have experience with before you went off to college? What was that?
Yeah, in high school, I'd say grass seed was what I was exposed to. That's what we did. That's what my dad did. He had a small, like a specialty seed plant, and he grew seed stock. And we had 200 varieties on 100 acres of grass and plants and, you know, flowers. We literally get a little Ziploc baggie that said, okay, we've gone out and hand collected this seed from the wild. We feel this is native and it's the only seed that exists, you know, grow it. And we'd start and you'd hand plant stuff and you'd go to plugs and you'd blow it up. Then you have 5-10 acres of it. And you'd be using real, you know, you'd take 45 minutes to harvest it and 10 hours to clean the combine out to get all the, you know, seed cleaned out. So, it was definitely different than what I'm doing now. It was very specialized and it was commercial, but it wasn't like you'd think of a commercial ag, you know, in potatoes, for example.
When you first got exposed to potatoes, what were your early impressions of the crop and the growing season and all of that?
You know, in the 90s, my dad worked for a guy here locally in potatoes, and my uncle was in potatoes. And so I had been exposed to it, just going to work with my dad and riding on the back of the digger and pulling vine and just being around it that way. So it wasn't totally new as far as what it was and what it looked like. You know, when you're used to many things other than vegetables, you know, potatoes is a lot of work. There's a lot of, you know, intensive, the applications you're putting on, the fertilizer, the sampling every week, the water, everything is just times 10 of a wheat crop or an alfalfa crop or a grassy crop for that matter. It just, there's a lot of stuff in it, and it starts the fall before, you know, doing applications and field work where, you know, a lot of crops will go over winter, but it's working around and planting it and you're done. There's a lot of management that we are involved in the fall on a spud crop, right? So I think that was my biggest eye opener, was just, you know, seeing that it's not a year round, because there, you know, this time of year, there's not a lot going on, but it was a lot more to it than maybe some of the other crops I had been involved in.
Now your operation, like I mentioned earlier, you're kind of in processing country. How does your operation break down, and, you know, what do you guys grow in the way of varieties?
Currently, we're just growing Rangers and Clearwaters. We've done 7 or 8 specialty varieties in the past, our baby bakers we've done. We've done a bunch of trial varieties. We're actually doing a trial variety now. That's kind of what makes it fun, is doing these new ones, right? I mean, there's only so many approved by McDonald's that you can really grow for a French fry. We all know that. So getting to do these new varieties that maybe you don't know how to plant and maybe you don't know how to grow them. Harvest is different and everything. So we like doing kind of these oddball things too, but currently we're just doing Rangers and Clearwaters.
Clearwater, that was one that was approved by McDonald's about 5 years ago. And how's that one going for you guys? Is that a variety you like?
Yeah, you know, it depends on time of year when you ask me which variety I like the best. Digging an early Ranger, it's hard to beat. The crop's beautiful. It's green. It hasn't had time to, you know, everything to go wrong on it. You know, it really looks good. You know, the Clearwaters hold up typically better than a Ranger does at the end. So when you're digging at the end of October or maybe the beginning of November to a processing plant direct, a Clearwater is some ways better. There are some issues. The longer we grow Clearwaters, I think the more people realize they are a little finicky in some ways. There are some problems with them. At first, at least I thought, boy, these things are great. You can't go wrong with them. And over the years, you start to kind of, you know, the armor's not quite as shiny anymore, and you realize there's some issues with it. But we're learning how to deal with that. That's part of the fun of, you know, doing these new varieties and figuring them out. Is once we do figure them out, I think it is a better way to go. It just, you know, one of the other problems with Clearwater is the acceptance. Not all buyers will take them. You know, there's certain restaurants that won't take Clearwater or a QSR. So having to, when you dig direct and you're kind of at the mercy of a pack plan and deal with the processor with their needs, with their customers, can get a little challenging. But overall, I do like the Clearwater.
And, you know, the average consumer, you know, they think russet or yellow or red. They don't realize how many dozens and hundreds of varieties there are in production, and they don't realize how many hundreds of thousands of potatoes are bred that just go nowhere each year. And we've got breeders all over the country working on this. If you had a chance to sit down with a breeder and they said, Grant, how can I make a better potato for you and your needs, what would be the traits that you would tell them?
You know, because everything in the processing world is compared to a russet Burbank, you have to start there. Whether it's the thing to do or not, you know, a russet Burbank may not be the best eating French fry compared to a Ranger French fry compared to a Shepherd. It doesn't matter. That's what people are used to, right? So when a breeder comes out with a variety that is nothing like a Russet Burbank, maybe the best growing, maybe disease resistant, maybe doesn't take any water or fertilizer to grow it. If it doesn't taste like a Russet or have the tech or the feel of a Russet Burbank, it's tossed. So while I would love to say, hey, let's breed this for X, Y, and Z, because it'd be really great to grow and we'd have less inputs, we'd be more sustainable with it. It really has to start with that Russet Burbank-esque potato. So that's, and I don't think that's a surprise to anybody. Everybody knows that. But that aside, you know, it's inputs, you know, less inputs. And, you know, part of that is an economic side for the grower, but part of it is, you know, less fertilizer, less water, more sustainable, right? So you're using less and producing more, you know, it's nice that it kind of fits in together, you know, higher yielding potato crop with less input saves you money, makes you money, and uses less from the environment. So I think that's the direction that everything's going, is less inputs, higher yields to produce more food with less acres and less inputs.
Absolutely. I mean, that sustainability is really, really topical and really front of mind for everybody right now. So yeah, I think that's the real trick we're all looking for. So as far as the region that you're in, Columbia Basin is one of the largest potato growing regions in the country. It relies heavily on the Columbia River and irrigation. Have you noticed any changes in recent years of different weather patterns, or just do you have any diseases or insects that you're kind of keeping a closer eye on than you used to?
So weather, everybody sits here in the spring and goes, oh my gosh, this year is so different. You know, it's really crazy this year. Every year is crazy. Last year I felt was the most normal weather year we had had, you know, looking at, but what's normal? You look back at the last 5 years, last year was stood out because it was normal, right? So it really, you have to put in context what time frame you're talking about. And I don't know, in the moment, you always think it's different. You always think it's weird. The things that I notice are some of the, maybe not disease, you know, I think disease pressure, late blight, early blight, white mold, that kind of stuff. I don't know that I've seen any trends one way or the other, but one thing we fight down here in the Southern Basin anyways, and it's pretty locally located here. You know, go 40 miles north, they don't even see them, but Colorado potato beetle. We really struggle. You know, part of that is, you know, we're on the crops in the Southern Basin typically don't grow full season, at least in average compared to the North Basin. So we're able to double crop down here. So we have a tighter rotation. So part of that's the issue, is we're not, you know, these bugs are allowed to build up maybe more than they are in the northern end, and they're harder to control, but we really struggle with them. We've really had to experiment with timing and rotating chemistries. And you think you find one thing works great one year, and the next year it just doesn't even touch them, right? They just walk right through it. So I think, you know, of the bugs, you know, psyllid was a big hot topic. I've never been too worried about psyllid. It never really turned out to be that big of an issue for us. Aphid, you know, aphid were actually down for us last year. It took a long time to find aphid, but beetle were here and mowing down as much as they could. You know, they're pretty voracious. So they were, I'd say that's the concerning trend I see right now, is just the increased pressure from potato beetle.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is just such a challenging insect because they do evolve and develop resistance so fast. So we're going to take just a quick break here for a message from our sponsor. Do you struggle with black spot or pressure bruise in your potato crop? The team at 1-4 Group has a solution for you. Their biocontrol 1-4 site has proven time and again to be the best sustainable option for delivering high quality potatoes. Incorporate 1-4 site into your existing storage program for unprecedented success. Learn more at 14group.com. And now back to the podcast. Last week, we just finished up Potato Expo, and the Washington, Oregon conference is coming up here in a couple of weeks. What sort of things are front of mind for you this time of year? You know, you mentioned already sustainability. What are you thinking about when you go into some of these shows and you get a chance to talk to some of these equipment manufacturers and crop protection sales reps and things?
Sure. You know, this time of year, I'm focused on education. That's really what it is. It's education for me. That all these breakout sessions that we have and hear from our researchers. You know, I'm the chair of research on the commission, the commissioner chair. So I'm exposed to a lot of research and researchers that the average grower probably isn't. But even with my exposure, I still don't really have a good understanding of the research and the results. So going into the potato conference or the expo and seeing that stuff presented by the guy that did the research, being able to ask questions, that's really what I look forward to in there. You know, as far as the trade show, you know, it's always good to go visit those guys, see what they have new. You know, you may see your John Deere rep once a month all year long, and you're going to go in there this time of year, you're going to see something. You're like, how didn't that ever come up? Right. I mean, how do I not know about that? And he goes, oh yeah, it's been out for a year. Well, come on. So it really just gives you an opportunity to learn stuff that I think even if you're around it, you're not getting another way. So I think that's the biggest thing for me is just learn as much as I can. Cause you get into growing your crop and you kind of, you don't forget about it, but you've pushed the side of your brain away of let's learn new things and let's just survive, right? Let's just get this crop through and apply the things I've already decided I'm going to apply. And at least that's the way my brain works. I don't really like experimenting a lot, stuff that just comes up in mid-season. I like to kind of have a plan and stick to that plan as best I can.
So besides potatoes, what do you grow anything else as far as cash crops or what rotational crops are you a fan of?
You know, just like anything, it takes so much to gear up to do anything. And a lot of times you go do 100 acres or something, you really got to gear up and do a couple hundred acres to really commit to it and make some money. Otherwise, you're just paying other people to farm it for you. You know, you're taking the risk and they're making money on, you know, custom and all that. So, but that being said, you do have to tie up ground and to get rotation set the way you want to and follow the crops you want to. We do a little bit ourselves. You know, this year, coming year, I'm doing some peas and sweet corn. Historically, that has been a pretty large rotation for us. We try to follow sweet corn when we can. Green peas and a double crop. We'll do a Timothy sweet corn. We've done grass seed here recently. It just kind of depends. You know, the good thing about not being set up mechanically to do all these things is that you can move around a little easier. If I'm set up for hay and I decide I don't want to grow hay that year, I have all this equipment sitting there I'm paying for that isn't moving. So I guess there is a balance there. We're able to move around and do what we think. And on a year where we think, you know, nothing looks great, we do have the option to go, you know, not do anything at all. So, but I'd say peas and sweet corn are mainstays.
Switching gears a little bit, your partner, Ed Schneider, he's always been very involved outside of his own farm in the way of being involved in the state and national ag organizations, and you've really taken to doing the same. Before you kind of got into that, what sort of conversations did you have with Ed on that subject, and what did he tell you as far as, you know, why it's important and why it's a benefit to you, and, you know, just personally, what do you get, you know, what do you find fulfilling about it?
Well, for those of you listening that know Ed, Ed's not necessarily the type to sit you down and say, hey, this is important and this is why you should go do this. He's more of a lead by example, right? And, you know, I've tried to keep my eyes open to that and see, you know, what, and we have lots of conversations. I don't think we ever sit down with a purpose of discussing one specific thing. They just randomly come up. We're sitting next to each other all day in the office. You know, it's pretty obvious all the things he's done and things he's been able to accomplish and the time he's devoted to the industry. I've tried to do my best to do the same. I see because he's done it. He knows it's important, but it's important to the industry. You know, people need to do this work. Otherwise nothing gets done. I mean, there's a lot of crops out there that don't have a potato commission or a U.S. potato board or potatoes USA or, you know, the MPC. So there is, I think the average grower might not understand the amount of work done by those three organizations for people in this state. You know, there was a pretty good tradition of people from this state getting involved both in the state organization and nationally. And, you know, it's also a tradition where you're kind of told you're going to do this stuff by certain, you know, when Ed got off, he told Jared Balcom, you know, you're taking my spot. And when Jared was getting done, a couple of years before he's done, he goes, hey, you're taking my spot. Are you ready? And, you know, eventually I was, and he got off and I moved into his. So, you know, part of it was the push, but I feel a responsibility, I guess, for lack of a better term, to go out there and volunteer and do this work. And not everybody's, I feel I'm pretty lucky. I got really good guys in the farm that can handle stuff day to day. When I go to DC or I got to go somewhere and do something in the middle of the year, it allows me to do that. I think a lot of guys probably don't have set up at home, you know, and Ed's slowing down doing things. So he's able to cover some stuff on the farm when I'm gone, which allows me to do a lot of stuff. But I think I like doing it. I enjoy it. I've been exposed to a lot of stuff that I never would have been exposed to. I never wore a suit in my life until I grew potatoes. That was something new. I never thought I'd have to wear a suit. And here I am wearing suits, you know, all through the year, all the time. So lots changed for me in that way. But I'd say it's more just kind of living up to, you know, filling the shoes of the people that went before me in the state. It's, you know, Ed's definitely a big one there, but even without Ed, there's a lot of guys in the state that have gone through everything here to kind of set the bar. And I think we all going to kind of live up to that.
You mentioned going to DC. One of the things I've yet to do is the DC fly-in. I just love asking people about that experience and being able to sit down with your representatives or your senators. What was your first DC fly-in like, and what did you take out of it?
You know, I always say I've been probably to DC 20 times since the first time I went now. I went in 2011 and I've gone quite a bit back since for these type of things. I've never gone there on vacation, actually just gone and seen things. But the first time you go to DC, you know, we're there to lobby, we're there to learn, we're there to do X, Y, and Z, but you can't help, your eyes are just glued open. I don't think you blink all day long, right? Because everything you see is like, oh my, look, there's the White House. Oh, there's the Capitol. Oh, look, you know, just constantly, your eyes are just peeled open. You're in a taxi going somewhere, and that's all you can do is just look, and you just feel, you know, oh, that's the Ford Theater, and, you know, you go, go, go. And then you get up to, the other part of that is you get up to one of the House offices where all your representatives have their offices, and you're walking through the halls and you're walking past all these names that you recognize on the door, right? So you're still kind of like, oh, you know, it's like seeing a celebrity almost, you know. You don't see a lot of them, but you see the name, and you know they're on the other side of that door. And you get in there, and you know, my first experience was the Leadership Institute, and I was there, and they at least the guys in Washington, Chris Voigt's really good at telling you you're going to do all the talking, right? And they tell you you're going to do all the talking, and they set you up and they make you read everything and they make you do all the talking, you know, a lot of the times. So you go in there, and it's, again, it's like meeting someone famous, right? And you know, you're not always meeting with a representative, but you're nervous for sure. And some people are more nervous than others for sure. But you get through it, and you know, as time goes on, year after year and more visits, you start to realize that, you know, they're just regular people. You know, it could have been your neighbor that got elected to Congress. I mean, Zeke could be a congressman. I could be a congressman. You know, we're not anything special. So once you get that through your head and you calm down a little bit, you know, after the, I'd say, second, third, fourth time you've been in there, you know, the first time there's a huge drop off. You get that out of the way. But eventually at this point, you get in there and you realize what you're doing is just, you're educating those guys. You know, they have so many things they're responsible for voting on, and really things that are shaping what we do, both in ag and the whole country. So, you know, it's our role to go in there and educate those guys and tell them our struggles, our problems, because they don't know. A lot of times they want to help you, but they just don't understand the situation or the issues or how that vote would affect you or this bill or whatever. So, you know, you get over the shock of meeting someone famous, and you get more focused on what you're there for. It makes it a lot easier. And you start realizing that you really are making a difference. It sounds corny, but I mean, there's lots of things the MPC has done on that hill, and everyone in our states and everybody that have made differences for the whole country, the whole potato country, and sometimes all of ag. You know, it's not just you, it's not your neighbor, it's your state, you know, it's everybody. So, you know, it's a pretty, you know, sometimes it's frustrating. You go on, it's not real receptive to you and everything, but at the end of the day, I think it's, you come out of that feeling pretty good. And a lot of times I think you can take a piece away from what you did and what you talked about, and then that's going to make a difference. That's going to help us. There's not always, like I said, it's not always that way, but that's, I think, what makes it worth going back over and over is just a little piece of the pie every time is worth it.
I would imagine that every time you go through your message, your story of your farm, you probably craft it a little bit better to make it more effective. It's, you know, it's the art of storytelling, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, and that's always a joke in that leadership program is by the end, you could give every person's spiel about their farm and their background because you've introduced yourself to 1,000 people, right? By the end of that, you could just, whoever's standing next to you, you might as well introduce them because you can do it. But you're right. You know, the first time you get done with it, I forgot to say that. And you get in a rhythm, the people that are in your group, you'll get used to this guy picking up that point and that guy over there picking up that point. And though it's not really choreographed that way, by the end of it, it's pretty smooth because everybody knows where to jump in. And when I forget something, that person can jump in. And so, yeah, the first couple of meetings sometimes can be a little rough because of my fault, just not being prepared well enough. But by the second, third, fourth one, you feel like you're presenting your message really clearly and that it's going to pay off.
Let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the COVID situation that had a big impact on food service, which you know processing is heavily reliant on. In your state, Washington, exports more potatoes than anywhere in the country. So you're very reliant on international markets, which have been volatile. The whole supply chain was really thrown for a loop because of the food service tail off. With that, the whole supply chain, is there something that this COVID situation kind of brought to light in our system that we could do better or that we need to change or needs to be more flexible?
Yeah, the COVID deal, that's a tough one. That one really, you know, depending on what numbers you're looking at, 85, 90% of what we grow in this state is exported out of the state. Being processing, there's a lot of QSR stuff. There's a lot of food service stuff. Even our fresh, a lot of that is all fresh potatoes are food service restaurants. So, you know, a lot of guys really got hammered, whether you're a fresh guy and you're just selling to a grocery store or a restaurant or the processing guys that, you know, that have contracts or thought they had contracts and you know, due to the situation, had their contracts cut or what they had in storage, you know, cut out of there. So, you know, I think, you know, a good thing that maybe came out of all this was it showed maybe the average consumer, you know, how delicate the food supply is. And it's not just, you know, everybody, you know, just an afterthought. It shouldn't just be an afterthought for everybody. It's a pretty major thing. And while COVID is a major thing, was a major thing, you know, it you would hope that even that wouldn't kill the supply of food around the world. So, I'd say going forward, I think everybody's eyes are a little more open to the possibilities, what could happen. We no one ever thought that after storing potatoes for 6 months that they'd be told, well, we're pulling your contract. I mean, a written contract that it's going out of here and now do what you want with it. It's gone. You know, we're not going to take them anymore. Oh, and by the way, the potatoes you already planted for next year, we're not going to take those either. I mean, it's guys were really faced with the end of their business. I mean, many guys, you know, and you know, a lot of guys dump potatoes, right? I mean, they disappeared, you know, they got out of there. And then shortly thereafter, things turned around. And for whatever reason, at that point in time, everyone came back to the table and said, okay, we want those, you know, we need those back now. And it seems like every time you talk to anybody, it's the outlook is good, the outlook's bad. We don't really know. I think it's important that, you know, when we're talking about contracts or with a processor or, you know, fresh guys, you really got to keep in mind that things can really go south now. So we can no longer, you know, before I don't think anyone would have thought that could have ever happened, those situations were going to come to our doorstep. So I think now, at least for myself, you know, when people are talking about negotiating contracts or what to plant for the next year, that's on your mind. You know, we gotta think about that stuff and we have to plan according to that. You know, whether that's what we should have to do or not, I don't know, but it's a scary deal for a lot of guys. I mean, even now, I know a lot of guys here locally that didn't tie up ground. They don't, as far as they know, they're not even growing potatoes because a processor hasn't even talked to them. They've been growing potatoes for several years for them and they can't even get a phone call back. you know, and I'm not necessarily blaming the processor for that. The processor doesn't know either, but you know, it's a tough deal. But you know, I'm 37 and I'm pretty fortunate that I came into an operation that was successful and was moving along and had shit. But there's a lot of guys my age that are just getting into it on their own, totally on their own. And they can't survive those things. I mean, they one bad crop, not just not selling your crop, but just a bad crop or a marginal crop would take them out and would end their farming career. I mean, it'd be over. I mean, they'd file bankruptcy. So it's scary. I mean, even for a guy like me that I feel I'm in a better situation than a lot just because of the work Ed's done, you know, and what Ed's built. I can't imagine being some of these guys that are facing that other stuff totally on their own with no backup. You know, it's scary for everybody. I know it's skippers and, you know, fresh guys and everything. It's a crazy situation still. And we'd like to think, you know, with this vaccine stuff, it's getting over, right? It's getting close, but who knows? You tell me, is it going away?
Your guess is as good as mine. You know, is this thing going to morph into something else and we got to go through the vaccine thing all again? I mean, who knows? You know, who knows? We can only cross our fingers and hope we're starting to come out of this. But yeah, I mean, I was talking to Dan Lake, who in Montana was, you know, of course, a seed guy who is, you know, a supplier for somebody like you, you know, and he's even further up the supply chain. And he's kind of like, you know, I don't blame the commercial grower and I don't blame the processing guy because nobody wants to be in this situation, but we all are, you know, and it's, you got to kind of be sympathetic to everybody. So it's just tough.
So. Yeah, it's easy to point fingers and say this part's to blame or that person's to blame. But I mean, like I said, nobody did this on purpose. Nobody knew that was coming. And looking back, there was probably some better ways to handle some things. But hindsight's always 20/20. I mean, you could have tried to do that. It would have been the wrong thing to do. So you're right. I mean, and it's top to bottom. Like I said, Dan's growing seed, right? A lot of the seed guys really got in bad shape last year because stuff just wasn't planted. And it was at planting when that happened. I mean, they had no time to adjust. And, you know, all the way up, I mean, top to bottom. I don't know of a single step along the way that people weren't affected, whether it's suppliers, you know, guys bringing in fertilizer, a retailer bringing in fertilizer for X amount of acres, and then they cut 30,000 acres out of the basin or whatever it ended up being. You know, that's a huge shift in any of these sectors of potato farming.
And what, you know, you talked about the consumer's knowledge of the supply chain, you know, that it's a 5-6 year cycle from a nuclear potato to a French fry. And when you cut seed acres somewhere along the line, there's going to be repercussions in following years that you might be short on seed. You know, and we don't know how that's going to play out yet. I mean, this whole thing is with the industry is not done yet, and it won't be done for a couple of years, I'm sure.
Yeah. You know, one thing, hopefully this opens guys' eyes to both consumers and everyone in the industry, is you're exactly right. You know, it's the butterfly effect. One small change is going to change something major 5 years from now. And here we had an enormous catastrophic change, and we're going to feel it. Even if things went back to normal today, they will be effects of this, whether it's seed shortages or whatever, it doesn't matter. For years. I mean, it'll be 10 years from now that people will be saying, well, yeah, this is the tail end of what happened, you know, during COVID. So it hopefully that's not real severe then, but it wouldn't shock me at all if we continue to see issues.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you if you have any advice for maybe somebody that was in your shoes coming out of college, you know, 15 years ago or so, a young farmer that's getting into ag, and what advice you might have for somebody that's in that situation to be as successful and as efficient farmer as they can be?
I don't know that I have a real good answer for you there, but, you know, I just think, like, if I could tell myself something back 15 years ago, whatever it was, when I got, keep your eye, everyone looks to the guys that are really successful and say, boy, look at how good they're doing, you know, they're doing things this way. That must be the reason for their success. And rarely do you really see the reason for someone's success. I mean, that's their competitive edge, right? They're not always real willing to go, oh yeah, here's my secret, right? Keep your eye out for bad things. And I don't mean necessarily a grower that grows bad, but everybody does bad. Everyone makes mistakes. Everyone makes wrong decisions. And I feel anyways, in my experience, that's guys will say, oh boy, that didn't, you know, don't do that. That didn't work for me. They might not always say, oh yeah, that worked great, but try to learn from other people's mistakes, I guess is my point. That, you know, you're going to try things, you're going to figure out what works for you, but it's better not to figure out what doesn't work for you yourself. You know, let your neighbor, let your partner that did it 20 years ago, let somebody else explain why that is the wrong decision to make. And here's why. You know, I've made plenty of mistakes myself. I am nowhere near immune to that problem, but I try to look out and keep a mental note of, boy, that didn't work for that guy. And maybe I don't want to do that. You know, maybe I try that, but on a smaller scale, you know, just watch out for, learn from other people's mistakes, I guess is my point. Do what you can that way. It's going to save you a lot of heartache, I think, sometimes.
Good parting words. Grant, thank you so much for coming on. We covered a lot of ground. I really appreciate your time and your insight. Thanks for listening, everybody. And thanks again to 1-4 Group, our sponsor. Be sure to go check them out at 1-4group.com.